And it's hour number three of this week's Blues Before Sunrise, Blues Heritage Showcase. I'm your host, Steve Cushing. Hey, this hour we're not going to be playing very much music, two or three records, but we are going to be doing something very interesting. We're going to be listening to an interview that I did to be included in a book I published back in 2014. It was called Pioneers of the Blues Revival. Basically, it was a collection, 19 interviews in all, with people who weren't black musicians, but were the white folks that went around and got interested in it and started promoting it. They had the record labels, published books and magazines, also managed to book a lot of the vintage bluesmen, and just supported blues in general. The person we're going to be talking to here, not this hour and next hour, is Jim O'Neill, who was the founder, publisher of Living Blues Magazine, along with his wife and Bruce Iglauer and several others. Also, he and his wife Amy started the Rooster record label, and also later on he did the Stackhouse label. And he's one of the few people, I'll tell you right away, knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. And his wife, Amy, used to have a radio program, and that listening to her show is what inspired me to do Blues Before Sunrise so many years ago. So it's mostly talk, and it's a telephone interview. There's a sound unit on there, and it does some strange things to the sound sometimes, but we'll try and keep it listenable. This interview was done in July 28th, 2006. And what do you say we give it a listen? Again, this is our interview with Jim O'Neill of Living Blues Magazine.
I was born November 25th, 1948 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. My parents were both from Mississippi, and so after 6 weeks, they moved back to Mississippi, so I never really knew Indiana. I grew up in Mississippi. My father was a minister at the time, but he became a doctor later, and my mother was a teacher.
What part of Mississippi were you from?
The Gulf Coast, really, around Biloxi, Gulfport, and I still have a lot of family down in Hattiesburg, a lot of cousins. Then I later in life, after I got into the blues, I moved to the Delta, but I didn't know anything about the Delta when I was growing up. I was listening to rock and roll, and I was collecting records since I was in the third grade. You know, the first records I bought were Fats Domino and Elvis Presley. But, yeah, I would just listen to the Top 40 radio, and eventually when the Rolling Stones and the British group came along, I started buying the LPs and looking at the liner notes and seeing who wrote the songs and trying to trace some of them back. And then that's when I realized most of the rock and roll that I liked was blues-based, and it came from people like Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed and Howlin' Wolf. At that time, I was in Chicago in college. I don't think any particular rock record got me interested in blues per se. It was only after I listened to some blues and realized that that's where it had come from, and that it really hit me. And the first blues album that I bought was at a Kmart in Mobile, which is where I went to school most of the time, from the third grade through high school in Mobile, Alabama. And it was an Albert King record, and I had only bought and that only. Spent 47 cents on it because I heard that he had played at the Fillmore, so he must be somebody I should check out. And then I listened to it, and I said, wait a minute, I've heard all this stuff before, but and this is the guy that recorded, you know, this is, I was hearing licks that Eric Clapton had done, and the Electric Flag, and all kinds of other groups, and that kind of really turned my head around, and then I started buying B.B. King, and then Muddy Waters, and realize where it all had come from. That was actually when I was home from college one summer. I think the summer was 68, I believe. So I was in the middle of my college career. Yeah, well, I went to Northwestern University. My parents had gone there. In fact, that's where they met. And like I said, they were both from Mississippi. And so I was kind of following a family tradition. And I, at that point, I wanted to get away from the South. I that was during the civil rights era, and I just didn't like a lot of the Southern attitudes toward things, and I thought I wanted to be somewhere else, and Chicago seemed like a fun place to be. I didn't know anything about the blues, you know, that's where it would lead me, but I'm glad it did. So I went to Northwestern, and I ended up in journalism and ended up combining my interest in blues and journalism by helping to start Living Blues magazine. Now, in 69, I started going around. I'd met Amy Van Singel, who was a student at Northwestern, and she was much more advanced in the blues than I was. You know, I was asking her, did she know about Mike Bloomfield? And she came back with me and said, do you know about Big Joe Williams? And it turned out she had worked for Bob Kester at the Jazz Record Mart and Delmark Records in Chicago. And with her, I went to the Jazz Record Mart and saw a whole store full of blues albums, and that really just kind of opened my mind to this hope that there was this whole other world out there, this blues world. And of course, Bob Kester was always a great contact for people who wanted to find out what was going on in Chicago, where to go to hear music in the clubs. And from him, you know, we got a club list and started going primarily to Teresa's, but also to Pepper's Lounge and a few places on the west side. It was basically wherever we could get in where they wouldn't check our IDs at the door, because we weren't 21 yet. But, you know, Pepper's and Teresa's, I guess, was the big experiences. And going to hear Otis Rush at Pepper's, I guess, was probably the big changing point in my whole life. That was just so much more powerful and intense than anything I'd ever seen of any kind of music. I think Otis's band at that point was Bobby Davis on drums, who was, a lot of people regarded him as a show drummer, but he could really do some stuff with the drums, and Otis liked him a lot. He had, I believe it was Ernest Gatewood on bass, and Jesse Green was around sometimes too.
And Otis was in good shape at that point.
Oh, Otis was magnificent, yeah. He was, I still think Otis at his peak, there's no one I ever saw who was better. Even when he was on an average night, he was better than 90% of the other artists, I think. But other artists at Pepper's, I remember Earl Hooker came in one night. I didn't get to see much of him because he died in 1970. But Junior Wells was there a lot, and Fenton Robinson, Lefty Diz, Little Mac, Hound Dog Taylor once in a while. They were just an endless parade of them at that point.
That was the original location for Pepper's. Where was that at?
That was at 43rd and Vincennes. And then Pepper moved a couple of years later to 13th and Michigan in the Loop, or what he called Blues in the Loop. It wasn't really the Loop. It was south of downtown. And
that was the Hall of Mirrors, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of mirrors there. I remember seeing Howlin' Wolf there one time. And Howlin' Wolf got so disgusted with the band, he told them all to get off the stage, and he was going to play guitar himself, play by himself. I remember just sitting there for about half an hour while he tuned his guitar, and nothing much ever happened.
I remember seeing Mighty Joe Young there. I think that was among my earliest in the Hall of Mirrors there.
Yeah, Mighty Joe Young. I remember he was there a lot, too.
How about Teresa's? Who was at Teresa's at that point when you were?
Teresa's featured Buddy Guy and Junior Wells together a lot, sometimes separately. And that was right when Phil Guy had come to town, too. So sometimes it was Phil Guy. Sammy Lawhorn was there. He wasn't with Muddy Waters anymore at that point, but he was around. Byther Smith sometimes. Occasionally, they'd have these great jam sessions on Mondays, Blue Mondays, and sometimes it would be James Cotton or someone like that. But sometimes the fairly obscure people would come by. I remember one night, Charles Clark, the guy who recorded Row Your Boat for Artistic or Cobra back in the 50s, he came by one night. But it's Junior Wells or anybody else. And I think I probably saw Junior more than anybody else all the time since I lived in Chicago. Yeah, Sleepy was the doorman, the assistant, or whatever you called him, I guess. Yeah, he was always helping out, and Teresa was there. Carl Jones was behind the bar sometimes, the guy who ran CJ Records. Or Junior was behind the bar sometimes, and Junior was also kind of the security guard. If he got, he made sure nothing would happen in Teresa's. You know, everybody was always telling me, you know, you're going to get killed going down there. And not specifically to Teresa's, but just to the south side or west side in general. But I think people like Junior Wells had a real protective attitude towards visitors who came to see them. They wanted to make sure that nothing happened, so sometimes they would walk you out to the car or just make sure that nobody was hassling you.
I heard that Carl Jones lived above the bars. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I think he lived there at 48th and Prairie. Yeah.
How about Peppers? That actually was turf for one of the notorious gangs there for a long while, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was probably the most dangerous place we could have gone, and that was the place we went most often, except for Teresa's, probably, because like I said, they never carded us to see if we were 21 to get in. Plus, their music was so great. And there were some near incidents at Peppers, but it wasn't usually involving the people coming to hear the blues. It was because it was in the gang territory. And if you, depending on what color hat you were wearing, could be in trouble, you know, if it was red or black. With the Disciples and the Blackstone Rangers, you know, once in a while, there were some minor hassles on the street. Some of the gang members would start talking or something, but not, you know, nothing ever actually happened. And one of the first times I went with some friends from college, and we were all kind of naive about the whole experience anyway, and it was like being in a whole different world to begin with. And this young guy sat down at the table with us and started beating out a rhythm on the table with his hands and spelling the word beware like we were going to get killed. But we made it out alive and still here.
Did you manage to get a degree? Did you manage to finish school?
Yeah, I got a degree in 1970 in journalism, and Amy and I got married during that time, and she got a degree in English. She went back to get a master's degree, but it was interrupted by having to do when the draft came along, and I did alternative service at a hospital in Chicago, at a mental hospital, for 2 years. Then I did actually go back and get a master's degree, although probably I didn't really use it very much because I was already publishing a magazine. Not that that was the great goal of most of the journalism students at Northwestern, I think. You know,
the mental hospital probably helped with that, I think.
Yeah, the mental hospital was a good experience.
At this point, you were seeing live blues in Chicago and you're going to school. Did you have any exposure to pre-war blues or any of the people that were playing it?
Oh, I was interested in it. You know, I thought the mission that we had set out to do was to document that the blues was a living tradition, so the magazine was always more oriented towards what was going on, you know, in the contemporary sense, who was still active, who was still playing. But I always did have an interest in pre-war blues, and Paul Guerin, who was one of the co-founders of Living Blues, was a pre-war expert. He had a great collection of 78s, and had known Big Joe Williams and a lot of those people too. So he was always a good source of inspiration and information. And I was interested in Tampa Red and some of the people who weren't around the scene anymore, although he was still alive, and I did manage to track him down and interview him or spend some time with him. I didn't do much actual interviewing with him. I think you spent some time with him too.
Yeah, where was Tampa when you caught up with him?
Tampa was living in an apartment on 54th Street. I think I'd gotten his address from Blind John Davis, who had given it to Bob Kester or someone. But, you know, Willie Dixon and some others had warned me not that Tampa had flipped his wig, as Willie Dixon put it. And I wasn't even sure it would be safe to go there, but he wasn't dangerous at all, of course. He just had gotten kind of senile and had a couple of breakdowns earlier in his life, I think after his wife died. But he was a nice, gentle man, I thought.
My impression, too. I thought, God, this is like the gentlest guy in the world. And then I read it at some point, wasn't he like a pyromaniac for a while or something?
Yeah, there were stories that he was the one who was hard to get along with, or had an attitude or something. But, you know, we don't know what he was like earlier in life, but I'm certainly glad that we got to meet him.
Well, the fact that Wolf looked up to him, that said volumes to me.
Yeah, I mean, everybody spoke well of him as far as an influence, you know, even Muddy and Junior Wells and people like that. They all looked up to him.
Yeah, there's Luther Guitar, Junior Johnson, and Hard Times on the Rooster label in June of 1983. If you're just now joining us, it's Blues Before Sunrise, and instead of our usual diet of listening to record after record, we're listening to an interview with Jim O'Neill, founder of Living Blues Magazine, also the editor, and also founder and owner and just general blues enthusiast for the Rooster label, where we heard Luther Guitar Jr. We've got more here. What do you say we listen to Jim as he talks about starting Living Blues Magazine?
Living Blues started as an offshoot, I guess, or another attempt to start a magazine through the crowd that was hanging around Bob Kester's there. I remember in 1969, there had been a sign-up sheet at Bob Kester's store for anyone who wanted to contribute some stories to a blues magazine to send them in. And I think Dick Sherman was going to be the one who put the magazine together at that time. Of course, it wasn't called Living Blues or anything. It was just an idea for a magazine. And I think I wrote up a concert I had just been to, which was actually my first blues concert, at the Kinetic Playground, which was B.B. King, Albert King, and Paul Butterfield. And not long after that, I saw a Howlin' Wolf concert with Paul Butterfield at Northwestern. But anyway, that I think Dick Sherman left town, and that magazine never actually got started. And in the meantime, Bruce Iglauer came to town and went to work for Bob Kessler as a shipping clerk. And Bruce and Amy and I had gotten together to hear music, and we started talking about having a magazine. Why isn't there a magazine here, since I was in journalism and we were all interested in it? So it just kind of grew from there, because we were all anxious to get all the information we could about blues, and it was kind of weird because the best source of information at that point was a magazine from England called Blues Unlimited, which some of us had contributed to at times, but it seemed weird to have to subscribe to a magazine in England to find out what was happening on the other side of town in Chicago. So that kind of was how it all got started.
When you put the magazine together, I don't know if Blues Unlimited was the template. Were there things that they were doing that you admired, or things that they were doing that you thought, we can do this better, or this needs to be different when we do ours?
Well, just by the fact that they were in England, thousands of miles away from the actual artist, except when they were on tour or when they would visit over here, you know, it gave them a whole different perspective. It was like, you know, the articles were like, we're on a blues safari and here's our stop in dangerous Neverland or whatever. or else the magazine was more, Blues Unlimited was more oriented towards records and discography, which I was always interested in too, but we always thought that the advantage Living Blues could have was that we were right there where the blues artists lived. We could talk to them, we could do these interviews, and we could get their take on what the blues was about, and get, you know, more personal stories that way. So I think that was the difference. But we always kind of felt that we were comrades with Blues Unlimited as well as competitors.
Were there other alternate titles ever considered other than Living Blues?
I can't remember if we had any other titles. Bruce Iglauer actually came out with the title Living Blues.
What was Bruce's background? I know he was working as a shipping clerk. Did he have a degree, and was it in anything?
Yeah, Bruce had come from Lawrence University in Appleton, and I forget what his degree was in, but I think he had graduated, and he had promoted a few blues shows while he was there, and had been into folk music before that. So he had a little experience when he showed up in Chicago, and he really got a lot of balls rolling once he got to Chicago with Living Blues and Alligator Records.
So, recapping here briefly, the incentive to do this magazine actually came from the handful of you. It wasn't something where Bob Kester said, I really think there needs to be a magazine and I'm recruiting you guys, that kind of thing?
Bob was always very supportive. He didn't recruit us, so to speak. No, he was just kind of our central guru, I suppose you could say. And he actually did loan us the money to help get the first issue out, and let us use the Jazz Record Mart if we needed a place to interview someone, which we did a few times. Like I said, he was always there for the information, and he gave me my first paying gig, blues writing gig, doing liner notes for a Magic Sam album. So he was crucial to the genesis of Living Blues, although he wasn't the creative force behind it, you would say.
Let's talk about the actual steps of getting the print content to the printer and actually published as a magazine. How many different steps were there, and how long did they take when you actually got things ready to roll?
Well, I'm not sure any of us had much experience in that. You know, I had done a little work on the high school and college newspapers, but it wasn't the same as actually laying out, designing, and publishing your own magazine. So Bruce and another of the co-founders, Diane Allman, did a lot of that work at the beginning. But basically, this is before the age of computers and word processing and all that. So the first issue, the actual text for the magazine, was typed on an IBM typewriter that we borrowed from the Chicago Seed, which was the underground newspaper. So if you look at the first issue, the print is all typewriter text, and then you'd have to type out the text and glue it down or wax it down to a page, and the printer would shoot negatives from that page and then print it. And we found the printer in Chicago who had done a lot of the underground press work. He printed some of the first issues. And then we went to Port Washington, Wisconsin, where the later issues were printed. And we'd have to drive up in our station wagon to Port Washington, get the magazines, bring them back down, bundle them up, and Bruce would send them out to distributors, and Amy and I would address them all to all the individual subscribers. So we did the whole thing.
Yeah, there must have been something pleasant about going to Port Washington with the blues tradition, huh?
Yeah, there was always the connection there that Port Washington is where Paramount Records had begun. But there didn't seem to be much evidence of it when we were there, although certainly there's been more that has turned up in recent years when people have offered a lot of money to find any relics of the Paramount label. But, you know, we would stop at junk stores and I'd be hoping I would find Charlie Patton 78. But nothing much ever happened, although the printer up there was also the publisher of the local paper, and we talked to him about that history, and which he was, I don't think he was very aware of it, but and he thought that was very strange that Paramount should have had an office in Port Washington, which was, as he called it, a lily-white town. It was one of those towns where if you were black, you weren't supposed to be there after sundown. Of course, there's a lot of towns like that throughout the Midwest. And, you know, that was just kind of an odd place for a great segment of African-American recorded history to have happened.
I guess you guys didn't look on top of the work sheds and the barns where all the masters were used.
I'd heard that some of the old metal plates from the Paramount Records were being used as roofs of chicken shacks and chicken coops and barns.
So these things were in actual size. You would actually make the template that would be used to shoot the negative would actually be real size.
Right. It was 100%. It wasn't on a computer screen or anything. Like I said, everything was done with paper and typewriter, or, you know, later when we got an actual typesetter, we still had to actually typeset the text onto paper, which was printed by a photo process, and still paste or glue that down to the layout paper. And then you would leave a space you'd cut out a black square for wherever the photos would go. Black piece of cardboard or construction paper, and you just give the photos to the printer with an indication of which one was supposed to go in which space. And of course, once in a while that would get confused and you'd get the wrong caption with the wrong photo with the other magazine. But it was all a completely different way to do it. And one time we were advancing beyond the typewriter stage, and we'd gotten this thing called a Verityper, which was a strike-on machine. It was kind of like a typewriter, but you could do different fonts on it. But it was huge, and it made a huge thud whenever you struck the key. And we were living in a third apartment at that point, and neighbors downstairs called the police and said we were playing drums upstairs.
You're a dancing whippersnapper, you can boogaloo. You can feel it go like a cross-cut saw. You know you ruined my log. You made the trip, but you were too well equipped, and you really popped the whip on me. You can pop a ring around like the roof, so roll and whip will subdue. This young whippersnapper really flipped her lid. She even popped the whip on Billy the Kid. You're a dancing whippersnapper, you can do the jerk. You do much out on the floor when you start to work. I was hypnotized before I realized that you really popped the whip on me. You're a dancing whippersnapper, you can move a loop. You. me. You're a daddy whippersnapper, you can do the jury. You do much out on the floor when you start to work. Hey, I said I shake it, but don't break it.
Okay, it was you and Bruce and Amy and Diane. Who else contributed to the magazine? Who were regular contributors in the early days?
Well, we had a couple of other Chicago people who were on board for a while, Tim Zorn and Andre Suffron. It's been years since I heard from either one of them. We couldn't pay anybody. But once the magazine got around, we started getting people who would send news in or reviews or articles. But it was just fans who really cared about the music who would send things in. But we eventually got a list of a staff of what we call contributing editors who would send things in from other places. We had like Tom Mazzolini from San Francisco, who started the San Francisco Blues Festival, and Pete Welding in Los Angeles. He contributed some to the early issues. He's gotten a little bit from Paul Oliver, who is the leading blues author from England. He didn't do much magazine writing but he was always in touch with us. So it was whoever was the kind of the hardcore blues fan who cared enough to write about it, send the news in the early days. Sometimes it was white blues musicians who knew what was happening in the black community, and they would send material in. Like I remember Anson Funderburg used to send things in, and once in a while we'd get a letter or something from Charlie Musselwhite. So it was just a network of fans, and you know, it wasn't ever a big business or much of a business at all, actually.
How did you know when a copy of the magazine had been completed?
I think we usually knew when the magazine was finished by the time the pages that we allotted for it were filled up. Sometimes the things we were waiting for didn't come in, and a lot of times that was my stuff more than anybody else's probably we were waiting on. And sometimes we'd get something finished. I remember probably the Thomas Dorsey interview or the Houston Stackhouse interview, one of those long ones. And they were much longer than we realized that would fit in the space that we had allotted in the magazine. So what a normal editor would be to just cut some of the text so that it wouldn't all, you know, you wouldn't have it all, but you'd get the essence of it. But what I preferred to do was to shrink the text. So instead of it being in 12-point type, you would shrink it down to maybe 8 or 9-point type, which you could barely read, but it would all be there.
Well, no, I think that's admirable. As a guy who doesn't like to do hour-long interviews, if somebody's got 3 hours worth of conversation, that's, you know, on the air, that's what I go with.
The printer would staple them and bundle them. They'd come in like bundles of 50 or 100, and then we would take it from there and mail them out to individual subscribers and to the distributors and bookstores and record stores that would sell, you know, maybe 5 or 10 copies.
The biggest shock in my life doing Magic Slim Record was that the pressing plant and everybody expect to be paid in front, but the distributor would not pay you for your records. In fact, unless you had something else to offer him, oftentimes he wouldn't pay you at all. Now, how did that work with you and the publishers, that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, we were obligated to pay for the magazine when it was printed, although we did get extended some credit as time went on, and the more credit we got extended, the more we had to come up with other ways to make money, and eventually that's where the Living Blues Cookout came from. That was an event that we had every year at the Club Blues on Halstead Street. It actually started elsewhere on Clark Street, but that was a fundraiser where we invite blues artists to come and have a picnic or a cookout or fish fry, and we'd sell records and try to make some money to pay the printer, and that became one of the sources of income once a year for a while. But it kind of caught you in between, like you say, because just like in the record business, you're obligated to pay for the product, you know, a long time before you actually collect any money from it from distributors, because the distribution system is set up where it used to be set up where they would pay you maybe in 30 or 60 days, and I think now that I'm in the record business again, and now it's 150 days.
Well, so you pretty much have to have some money to keep this thing afloat, and Lord knows that you don't see any profit.
Right, so everything that we made from the magazine went back into it just to keep the next issue coming out. And the way we started making some money to support our activities and pay for our rent or whatever was selling records, because, you know, at the same time that we'd be going around to clubs on the south side or west side or visiting musicians and interviewing them. There were also record stores where you could still get J.B. Lenore records for a dime or a quarter, and I could sell them overseas for $2. I could advertise them and sell them to someone in England, and that was big money then. And I wish I had some of those records now.
I remember you got me started on the Reverend Gates. You had a stack of about, was it 8, 9, 11, really beat up Gates 78s. And I was just fascinated. I don't think he even had a 78 stylus at that point, but I bought them all and took them home, and I think Kester played them for me or something. And boy, I was off and running.
All right. Yeah, there was a guy at who used to work at Kester's. His name was Bob Barron. He was a student at the University of Chicago. Remember, he was the one that clued me in that you could go down to the South Side and find these records, you know. So that became a regular thing. Or wherever I would go, and, you know, if I'd go down south to Memphis or Mobile, I would find the black record stores that had been around a long time and see what they still had anything left. A lot of times, you know, the older material wasn't regarded as valuable, so that would be like on a table or in the attic or in the basement for a quarter or something.
I remember that, in fact, it all comes back to me now. I hadn't thought about it in years that, you know, the house where you and Amy live used to be a regular stop for me on payday Fridays, you know, to be Jazz Record Mart and Sounds Good. What was the one, was it called Wax Tracks on Lincoln?
Yeah, Wax Tracks.
And, you know, Jim and Amy's, and would have some imported stuff from time to time. Yeah, God, those were the golden days when I actually had an income, and there were still records that I wanted to buy, you know.
Another way that the whole record business worked was that we would get advertisements from these small independent record companies, and even though an ad in Living Blues didn't cost much, it was still a lot of money in terms of cash for a small independent label to pay out. So what we would do a lot of times was just trade them a box of records for an ad. So they'd take out an ad, and we would get 25 records or whatever it was, and then we'd sell those through our mail order catalog and get the money back that way.
Enterprising, huh?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the features in the magazine.
Well, I think the Living Blues interview came to be the centerpiece of it, which would be an in-depth interview with a blues artist. And that hadn't been done much, that kind of depth. I mean, there'd been a lot of articles written, but they would be, first they would be shorter, and second they would be in the writer's words, often not even quoting the musician. So what we would try to do was, if there were articles that were just like written by most of the articles were just like regular historical or narrative kinds of articles. But I would always try to get the writers to include some quoted material from the musician, so you get a little more personal sense of their personality, and so it wouldn't be quite so just an objective list of facts. So the interviews and those kinds of articles were the main focus, and we felt an obligation to cover who the popular blues artists were at the time, but also to try to kind of dig into the woodwork, I guess you'd say, and find the guys who were just playing the small juke joints or ghetto blues bars, or maybe people who weren't playing at all, just people we'd heard about who were playing at home or who might get out and play if someone would book them. And that became a big thing, too. Once we'd interview someone, we'd always get offers to either a booking agent or manager or a record producer. Managed to stay out of that for a long time, but I eventually did get into that. A lot of times we or perhaps someone from Blues Unlimited or the Swedish Blues Magazine or somewhere like that would have been the only journalist to have ever interviewed any of these artists. So, you know, we were kind of the connection to the outside world. You know, they knew there was gigs coming in Europe, or where there were, after a while, the festival phenomena started. You know, so, you know, we ended up being the middleman for a lot of things. You know, all we didn't try to be a booking agency, except when we had to.
Yeah. In terms of the interviews, how much of a sense of desperation did you have in terms of trying to catch people who were aged? I mean, was there a sense of, I mean, that's the thing that I find, is just trying to catch people before they're gone.
I don't think when we started Living Blues, because we had that title, Living Blues, you know, we thought this is a living music, and one of the first things we learned we had to deal with was that every issue we had to report some more deaths, you know, and I became a prolific obituary writer. And so it did, and it didn't. I don't think we realized that at first, how important it was to get to some of these people. But yeah, certainly it is, has become more of an issue now. Although I think, in general, blues is very well documented, perhaps over-documented, at least in comparison to some other kinds of music.
Can you talk about how you handed off the stewardship of Living Blues magazine? How did that come about?
Amy and I had been publishing Living Blues out of our house in Chicago, and also trying to run the record label Rooster Blues. Getting to be a lot of work, and it got to be more than we could handle. Really, it seemed like trying to keep the magazine going, because Amy couldn't work full time on it, and in order to make enough money to do all that, we'd have to bring in other income, which would both be me trying to do a mail order business or other freelance jobs, or Amy getting a job as a typesetter or with a magazine or something. So she learned the trade from what she learned doing at Living Blues. You know, she actually got to be a professional typesetter from typesetting the magazine. It was kind of overwhelming us. Plus, at the same time, I was still spending money on collecting records. And I had this huge record collection that was lots of unfiled material of photos and clippings and all kinds of memorabilia about the blues. And we'd gotten in touch with Bill Ferris at the University of Mississippi, and just through some conversations with him, that we found out that the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at Ole Miss was doing some publishing and also a lot of other kind of documentary projects and educational projects about the blues. And they were actually interested in publishing a magazine, and we thought this would be great because we could still edit it and they could publish it and have all the headache, and we'd get some money from it, you know. But the deal was that we would get 50% of the profit. There was the key. So if the years went by and there were no profits, but they kept the magazine going, and eventually they made an agreement just to pay us a little bit every once in a while to make up for the lack of profit. So I still actually work with the magazine. They send me the articles, and I try to proofread them for accuracy, and I still do some writing for the magazine. I still edited the magazine after the university took it over. But they've been publishing it now for 23 years, so they've certainly shown a commitment to it.
When did you actually relinquish officially the editorship of the magazine?
87 was when I finally resigned and left Oxford and moved over to the Delta. And it was partly because the pull of the Delta was too strong on me, because Oxford's a nice college town in Mississippi, but it's not like being in the Delta where all the blues artists were. I was always, every weekend I was just leaving Oxford, going to Clarksdale or Greenville or Indianola or somewhere. So I figured I might as well be over there and really be into it. And then Amy and I got a divorce at the same time. Amy and I stayed together the whole time that we had something to do with Living Blues. It kind of all fell apart at the same time, too. So I had a little money from selling the house in Chicago to invest, starting something in the Delta. So that's where that came from.
You're tuned to Blues Before Sunrise. If you're just now joining us, we're listening to an interview with Jim O'Neill, who owned and operated, founded Living Blues magazine, and along with his wife, Amy Von Singel, also did the Rooster record label. And I thought, since we're listening to Jim O'Neill tell his story, it would probably be appropriate to play some of the records on his label, on the Rooster label. So let's grab a few of these here. What we listened to before was Billy the Kid Emerson and Dancing Whippersnapper from 1964, featuring Lonnie Brooks on guitar. And what do you say we listen to something else on the Rooster label? He had a CD called Funny Stuff by the artist Larry Davis. Let's give it a listen. Thank you.
out into a world of darkness, and I know you'll be right there. Oh, can't you see?
I won't fly over a woman in the bed and won't turn over. Look for something, no, it ain't there. Get back now before you lose your hair. Sitting around the house watching TV all day, trying to see what's gonna come my way. Rent is due, lights ain't paid, trying to get ahead of things going away. Hey, blues is all right. Hey, blues is all right. Is all right. Hey, blues is all right. He's in a minute, but I won't fly over. Woman in the bed and won't turn over. Look for something, no, it ain't there.
hair. Get back now before you lose your hair. Sitting around the house watching TV all day, trying to see what's gonna come my way. Rent is due, lights ain't paid, trying to get a headache ain't going away. Hey, blues is all right. Hey, blues is all right. All right. Hey, it's all right. Somewhere don't wanna be late. Sitting on the highway, time passing by, trying to get a headache and going away. Thinking, hey, who's all right? Thinking, hey, who's all right? I've been thinking, hey, who's all right? Thinking, hey, who's all right? We'll be right back.
Yeah, good rockin' Charles, She Loves Another Man from November of 1975. Before that, Eddie C. Campbell on a CD on the Rooster label, Hopes and Dreams. What we heard was Geese in the Ninny Bow from 2000. And we also listened to Larry Davis to get us started. And Since I've Been Loving You from 2001 off a CD called Funky Stuff, Larry Davis on guitar and vocal. Well, that's got the first hour of our interview with Jim O'Neill, the founder of Living Blues Magazine. We're going to pause and identify the station, and then we'll be back with hour number two. Jim and his story, again, the interview was done originally July 28th, 2006.
I've been mistreated all my life. I've been mistreated. I've been mistreated all my life. Well, I was in love with my baby. You're not in love with my little wife. Well, I went out. Come out bad, looking trouble.